This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. After spending over 2 months in northern Iraq, Charles Sennett returned home to London this week. Sennett is a foreign correspondent for the Boston Globe. He's a former Middle East bureau chief for the Globe and covered the war in Afghanistan. We last spoke on Fresh Air a couple of weeks ago, just after he gained access to the terrorist camp in northern Iraq run by the militant Islamic group Ansar al-Islam. This was right after the camp was taken over by U.S. Special Forces and Kurdish fighters. During Sennett's travels through northern Iraq, he stayed in touch with a brigade of Kurdish fighters. He was with them when he reported on the liberation of Kirkuk, the oil-rich city in northern Iraq, which Saddam Hussein ethnically cleansed of its Kurdish population. Sennett had become friends with the brigade's commander, but the commander didn't get to see the liberation of the city his family is from. He was killed in the fighting at Ansar al-Islam. Earlier today, I asked Charles Sennett to tell us about some of the Kurdish fighters in this brigade who did see the liberation of Kirkuk.
Well, these men were very interesting warriors. They are fighters for the Kurdish opposition. They've fought Saddam's regime for at least 20 years, all of them.
So they're no youngsters.
They're not youngsters, and I think maybe that's why I related to them. Feeling like an aging warrior myself in this war zone, to be hanging out with fighters in their mid-30s to even 40, it gave them a completely different perspective on this war. When they lost Tariq, they were very emotional about it. They had a very stoic sense, as the Kurdish fighters do, of letting it go and realizing that, you know, the name Peshmerga, which is what they call their militias, means to those who face death. And they accept death, but they had a particularly hard time accepting it with Tariq because he was such a unique individual, such a great reputation, not only for fighting, but as a friend and as a very funny man. He made us laugh very hard. And they, in the brigade, had seen us getting to know Tariq. And so when we went in on our own, but we quickly met up with probably 10 other members of the unit, all of them from Kirkuk, which made their story very unique. They had all been forced out of Kirkuk for at least 12 years, since 1991. Some had been forced out even earlier. Many of them had participated in the failed uprising of 1991 and suffered the real brutal response to that from Saddam's regime. So this moment when they came in meant so much to them on so many levels, and we were able to know several of those levels. And we also just experienced that moment, that incredible moment of when the big bronze statue in the center of Kirkuk came down. I was standing with them, and they were hugging each other, and they were hugging me, and they were saying things like, if only Tariq had been here to see this. And so it really was a very personal level on which we were able to experience that liberation.
But here's one of the things that they and a lot of Kurds are up against now. The Kurds who are ethnically cleansed from Kirkuk might want to go home now, but in their homes are going to be Arab people who are living there because they moved in when the Kurds were ethnically cleansed. So who claims the right of ownership to those homes and to that land? I mean, this is a real problem up ahead, isn't it?
This is what makes Kirkuk so complicated, and what I think makes Kirkuk actually the truest test of the interim government as it takes shape with the United States and the Iraqi opposition leadership and those members of the Iraqi government who will become part of the interim government. Kirkuk is a tinderbox, an ethnic tinderbox made up of Arabs, Kurds, the Turkoman, who have been there since the Ottoman Empire, and Assyrian Christians, among others. Those groups all have a kind of roiling tension that's going on between them, and all of that tension was playing out on the street. And you're absolutely right. There are Kurds who are returning, who know now that there are Arab families who've been assigned to their homes by Saddam's so-called policy of Arabization, which he started really in the late 1980s in earnest. Many of the Arabs, fearing the Kurdish return, had left, certainly those Arabs who came in as recently as the late 1980s. The Arab families who'd been there longer when the policy of Arabization first got going in the 70s. I think they have stayed on. And what we heard in many cases was the Kurds are willing to allow them to stay there until the situation is resolved, until the deeds for all of these homes can be obtained and all of the paperwork can be gone through. And so one of the critical components of the return to Kirkuk was actually seizing those documents, getting into the equivalent to City Hall and capturing the documents before they could be looted or stolen or burned or destroyed in some way. And that actually was part of the political component of the Kirkuk Brigade's responsibility. That was their job. And I was with them when they seized a large group of these files. I'm not sure if it was the entire file for the city, but it certainly was a pretty significant number of filing cabinets full of old deeds. And they felt confident that this will give them a start in trying to undo the history that Saddam had put in place in Kirkuk.
One of the great historical tragedies of the war is the looting of the museums of Iraq. Were there museums in northern Iraq that got looted?
Yeah, the first day, I did not have time to go to the museum. It was one of those scenes where you're rushing to accomplish your work, and you kind of, I remember driving by the museum thinking, my God, I wonder if that's been looted. And on the second morning, I went in to see, and of course it had been completely looted within the first hours of the collapse of the regime in Kirkuk. The guard was there who had witnessed the looting, and the museum director was there who had also been present when most of the looting took place. And they both told us that it was fighters who claimed to be part of the Peshmerga, or the Kurdish forces, who came in at gunpoint and cleared the shelves of pieces that date back to the Babylonian time, through the Sumerian era and the Assyrian Empire. The big fear here is that this was not just chaotic looting, but that there may actually be an organized attempt through an underground and a black market in these pieces to have seized the moment. A lot of the museum directors who I spoke to and some of the experts on this in the Kurdish-controlled part of the north who were very concerned about it said that the speed with which these pieces were taken and kind of the efficiency with which it was done indicate that it may be a professional ring. So they're investigating it and they're very worried about it.
So when you say that people in the museum said that the people doing the looting claimed to be members of the Peshmerga, the Kurdish fighters, did the people in the museum doubt the claim?
It's impossible to know because it was just such a chaotic scene with all of these forces wearing these kind of baggy tan pants, sneakers, and a shirt that just says PUK on it, and a Kalashnikov rifle, and the traditional headscarf. All of them just rushed into the city, and it's very difficult to know if indeed that person who came to that museum and said, we are with the Kurdish forces or the Peshmerga, indeed was. It's impossible for me to know, and it's even impossible for this museum director to know. You don't necessarily ask someone with a Kalashnikov for their ID or for their names or for what division they're from. And, of course, this official, who was a Turkoman from Kirkuk, who ran the museum, was really frightened for his life because the truth is he was part of the regime. And so he was very quiet and stood by as most of these items were taken out. Now, he claims that many of the items in the Kirkuk Museum were actually replicas. And in an interesting twist, some of the Kurdish officials I talked to are very worried about that claim. How do they know they were replicas? And where is the paperwork that can prove these were replicas? And if they are replicas, where are the originals and where were they kept? And all of this becomes this investigative process, almost like a crime story, in which people are just beginning to gather all the facts to find out what has happened to their history and how did it vanish and what will it mean for Iraqis when they return and their history has been stolen from them. So this is a very intense corner of this story that's going to unfold, I think, in the next few months or even years, where they'll be looking for these pieces to emerge in the black market.
Do you think this could have easily have been avoided?
I do. I think with a little bit more planning, a little bit more foresight on the part of the officials on both sides, they could have had more telephone contact, for example, or sent messages in to the museum directors to say, we have someone who is assigned from our Peshmerga. This is their name. This is the, you know, this is the code word. As soon as they get there, you relinquish the museum to them. Certainly, these messages were communicated for other areas of Kirkuk. For example, the huge tribal lands that were held by the Arab families. There was direct communication between the Kurdish opposition forces and those Arabs who owned that land. Messages were sent back and forth through the smuggling routes, even during the war. And if that kind of attention could have been paid to vast tracts of farming land, certainly that kind of attention also could have been paid to the museums that hold their history.
Charles, how did you know it was time to leave?
Well, I knew it was time to leave because I really felt like the story was winding down. I think the story of the war was in its final stages. I think the last piece of it was Tikrit, and we were hearing that there was no opposition in Tikrit, and certainly the large-scale fighting was over. I think there will be a lot of fighting that will continue in small pockets in all of these cities all over Iraq. But we really felt like it was time to go. I have a family. I have four boys under the age of five, so it's a pretty extraordinary pressure on my wife when I'm away that long. My brother has children. I was traveling with my brother, and he had just been through a pretty traumatic experience. And we just kind of looked at each other, and you just know, let's start working on getting out of here. And we made our decision and just began working on trying to leave.
You mentioned that your brother had a pretty traumatic experience. It's a pretty extraordinary experience. Why don't you tell us what happened to your brother?
It was on the first day.
Let me stop by saying your brother's a photographer who works for the Minneapolis Star Tribune. And you were traveling together. He was traveling with the reporter who he works with. You were traveling with your brother, that reporter, and another reporter from a British newspaper. Do I have that straight?
That's correct.
And so what happened to your brother?
My brother, Rick, is a very good photographer, very aggressive, and we were rushing down the road towards Kirkuk that morning, and you literally could see the abandoned positions on the roadside, people coming out and starting to celebrate, very chaotic scene, and we were separated on the road. And I went into the center of town and began reporting there, watching the bronze statue coming down. I kept looking over my shoulder thinking, it's very unlike Rick not to be right on this image, which was a powerful image of the liberation. But I figured if he's not here, then there's probably somewhere I should be. So I later learned that Rick was actually one of the first reporters to push forward to the collapsing front line. And as he did that, he drove toward the oil fields where there was an oil fire burning. A very powerful image in the oil field burning, because the fire is enormous, and it's so much a piece of the story of Kirkuk because of its vast oil reserves and a sense that it is the ultimate prize of the North because of that oil industry. And Rick wanted to capture that image quickly. What he didn't realize was there were still Iraqi forces in that area who had not yet completed their retreat. And there were elements of the Fedayeen, which is the almost like a volunteer force that Saddam had created, and it became one of his more brutal pieces of his military apparatus that was able to recruit fighters from Syria and other Arab countries. And they're particularly tough and particularly dangerous and particularly had an eye out for killing Americans. Rick began to move forward on the road, and two Kurdish fighters stopped him and said, we think there are Iraqi soldiers in here who have not yet left. Rick and the reporter who he was working with, Paul, pulled back and stopped to watch, because if there was going to be a fight, they would have been on top of it and they would have been able to document it. What happened in the next few minutes was a military truck, literally, as my brother describes it, came out of the smoke from the oil well fire directly toward the Kurdish forces. Two men were in the truck. One was driving and holding a rifle. One was a passenger and had a grenade pin in his mouth and another grenade in his other hand and a Kalashnikov over his shoulder. And he jumped out of the truck, and there was an engagement between the Kurdish forces and him. They literally were grabbing each other by the throat, which I think is the most powerful image my brother took. And there was a struggle going on. What my brother didn't know was happening, and later learned had happened, was the Fedayeen soldier said, "We don't have a fight with you, Kurdish fighter, but we want to kill those Americans down the road."
Those Americans being your brother and the reporter from the Star Tribune.
And the reporter Paul McEnroe from the Star Tribune. They let the Fedayeen fighter, who had the grenade in his mouth and one in his hand and the Kalashnikov across his shoulder, go. Some agreement had been struck in which he would not pull the pin on the grenade and kill the Kurdish fighters if they let him go, and he quickly disappeared. They then turned and shot the other fighter who was with him because he did not have a grenade on them. He fell. He is dragged out of the truck and left on the side of the road. Rick and Paul are documenting all this and, of course, wondering where did that other fighter go, because there is a large field between them and the road they are on in which this fighter has now disappeared. They stayed, in retrospect, maybe a little too long, documenting this scene. And as they turned to get ready to go, they saw the Iraqi soldier who had lived, who had the grenades, running down the road towards them, and they basically jumped in their car and drove away and got away. But he clearly had been kind of lying in wait to kill them. We believe that that soldier was then killed by the Kurdish forces. And what was strange about all this was Rick and Paul had had this very frightening experience and some very powerful images that they documented of the experience. And I happened down the road 45 minutes later and actually saw the first soldier, Iraqi soldier, the Fedayeen fighter, who we now know is from Syria, lying on the side of the road. This is the first one they had shot who had been driving the truck. I had no idea who he was, but when we drove up to his body, there were Kurdish soldiers kicking him in the head. And every time he tried to lift his head, they would kick his head again. And he was clearly in the throes of death, clearly suffering, had been disarmed. Myself and another reporter basically asked them to try to get him to a hospital, to take him and put him in an ambulance or put him in the back of any vehicle they could find and get him to a hospital. If the war is over, if he's unarmed, why not do that? And they came running out with passports that were Syrian and said, "He is a Syrian." And they tried to kill Peshmerga. He didn't say they tried to kill Americans, but we know now from the photographs it was the same body, the same person who had tried to kill my brother and the other reporter, Paul. So eventually they put him in the back of some beat-up vehicle in the trunk, and his head was literally kind of hanging out the side. You could tell he was barely clinging to life, and they told us they would be driving him off to a hospital. But our sense was that had we not shown up, they were about to kill him. And so we just a weird coincidence in a war zone to have paths cross like that and not realize this is the same fighter who had minutes before tried to kill your brother.
Well, that's the thing. When you tried to spare his life, you didn't know he had tried to kill your brother. Then you finally found your brother and figured out that the guy you had tried to save was the guy who had tried to kill him. So did you have second thoughts about trying to save his life after that?
No, I didn't. And I don't think my brother would either, actually. You know, there was a point where even Rick and Paul were saying, if that guy's not dead, you should take him to the hospital. They could see him dying. So I think even when you're a reporter and you're caught up in the middle of the fighting and you feel the intensity of all of it going around you, I think those of us who've done it before realize you're not in this fight. And as much as you can recognize the sense of hatred of one side toward you, and the sense of them, frankly, in this case, being on the wrong side of history, I don't think that diminishes your sense that they're still human beings, and maybe in the aftermath of this war, should be given a chance at a minimum to live.
Well, you know, your brother published photographs in the Minneapolis Star Tribune of the fighter who tried to kill him, and there was a photo of him dead, lying on the road as he was abandoned, as the Peshmerga were driving on. Pretty incredible to publish a photograph of the, you know, a guy lying dying, a guy who tried to kill you. Did you talk to your brother about the photograph and about having it published?
I did. I wish my brother was here. He's traveling, and he would be more eloquent than I could be on this topic. But he felt very strongly that they had seen this war on a very personal level from the beginning to the end. And it was almost a strangely fitting closure to a story for them that it got that personal, that the war became something that involved them directly and in which they were targeted. And when that happened, and when they had that intense personal connection to the end of the story of the liberation of Kirkuk, they both felt it is time to call it a day. And I think they felt that not just personally because of their safety, but I think they felt it journalistically, in that this was a very personal experience, and that's how it ended, and they're ready to let it go.
When your brother and the reporter Paul McEnroe realized that they had survived this very close call, and then when you met up with them later in the day, did you do anything to celebrate the fact that they were still alive, or did you just kind of get back to work and keep going?
Well, I in fact worried about them all night. Did not hear from them until I got a message the next morning. Mm. Then I called them and immediately headed for the city where they were, which is Sulaymaniyah, which is about an hour and a half from Kirkuk, and in relative safety. And, you know, as soon as I heard that, I worked for a couple hours to reach my brother, because one of the things about being in a war zone is communication is extremely difficult. So as soon as I could get to him, I did. But I actually didn't know about it for too long, frankly. It was one of those situations where I kept asking all of our friends who are colleagues, have you seen my brother? Have you seen Paul? And when we finally met up, yeah, there was really an intense sense of, let's go through this. How did this happen? And how did you get out there that quickly? And, you know, you always second guess yourself, and you revisit these trips and you ask yourselves, did you do the right thing? I don't know if you can ever come up with a true answer. All you do is fall back on the idea, hey, I'm glad you're alive. And in this case, you know, not just glad that a colleague's alive, but glad that my brother was. So yeah, we celebrated. We had one of these warm, horrible beers that you can get in northern Iraq called Efes, and we were very happy to see each other.
Did you feel like you came across a lot of stories in northern Iraq that were astonishing yet not quite appropriate for the Boston Globe, your newspaper?
I think every reporter who's working the story, you end up with two different realities happening. You are essentially trying to cover the war, or at least your piece of it. And the amount of time you spend waiting for that piece of your war to happen is so much longer than I think people who watch CNN realize. You cover a front line for days and weeks, and you wait for it to move, and you wait for that moment when the airstrikes start. And certainly in northern Iraq, the waiting was even longer because of the failure of the opening of a massive northern front. The gains were incremental. And so the reporting side of it is almost like one file. Then you have a split-screen separate file, which is your personal story of the people with whom you're living and the people you're getting to know. And for us in the Kurdish areas, those relationships were very intense. And a few of them were, for example, getting to know Dr. Bakhtiar Faik, who's the doctor in Halabja, who is still struggling every day with thousands of patients who suffer the after effects of the 1988 gas attack on Halabja, which really made it synonymous with Saddam Hussein's use of chemical weapons. He works every day with young teenage girls or girls in their 20s who suffer from very complex cancers, with people who've been blinded by the attack, congenital birth defects, miscarriages, which are at a rate 15 times higher than a similar-sized village that they've done a comparative study with. And you become very personal with these people and very close to them. And when George Bush in the White House announces that we're going to be fighting in the name of these people of Halabja, against whom Saddam Hussein used a chemical attack on his own people, and then you talk to Dr. Bakhtiar, who's a very polite man, who quietly tells you, yes, well, that's true, but where were they 15 years ago when this happened? Why didn't they condemn the attack then? Why didn't the United States provide any medical help to the victims of Halabja? And you begin to know his history, and you begin to know his sense not only of suffering the attack, but of being used for years and decades and even generations by all of the vying powers in Iraq. And when Liberation Day happens and you look in his eyes and you know all of that history, it doesn't fit in your daily newspaper story. But it's what makes being a reporter who's not embedded, who's not with the U.S. military, but who spent time with the people on the ground, a very intense and, I would even say, rewarding experience, in that I think you get to know the complexity of the whole story.
When you were in northern Iraq, did news of the death of the two American embedded journalists, Michael Kelly and David Bloom, reach you?
Yes, it did. And, you know, all of us were, of course, terribly saddened by the news. But I think a lot of people also knew Michael Kelly. I had met him briefly, and I know that there were many correspondents who knew him very well. He'd done outstanding work for the Boston Globe, for one thing, in the first Gulf War. And it just came as such a... I don't know. I mean, it's not a shock, because in a way you're almost expecting to hear this horrible news. But when you hear that news about someone who is such a respected colleague, who on many levels didn't have to be there, he had proven himself in so many different conflicts and in so many intense levels, I think he wanted to return as a kind of bookend for a career that really began with the first Gulf War and could end with it. And I think there are many of us, including myself, who came with that kind of framework, that, you know, one of the first experiences many of us had was the first Gulf War. And now here's this other one. And when you hear of a correspondent who's done so much with his life and so much with his work in those intervening years, and who has a family, children, it is a deeply depressing moment. And everyone just kind of stops, and everyone gets very quiet, and all of the personal calculations of why are you here begin to take effect, and you begin to go through all of your reasons again. And I think everyone does this every time they hear tragic news like that. Why am I here? Is this worth it? Is it time to get out? Is this story that personal and that intense for me that I am willing to risk my children not having a father, and, you know, your wife not having a husband, and your mother not having a son, your brother not having a brother? And you do these calculations often, but of course most intensely when you get news like that.
Is part of that personal calculus that you have to do figuring out how much of wanting to be there is bearing witness to a really important story and how much of it is about career?
Yeah, I think a lot of it is career motivated, to be honest. I think a lot of correspondents get into this zone where they don't want to miss the big one, where they really want to be part of the big story. It's a genetic flaw of journalists, if you will, that we get addicted to being close to the flame. But I think for the journalists, for the good ones who really care about the story, who've really gotten to know the Middle East, I think there's a lot of really feeling an obligation of reporting it accurately, of wanting to get there so that you can bring all that history that you know, so you can bring all of that layered complexity to the story as best you can, and to do it in a way that someone who has never covered the region, they just can't do it. And you know that, and it makes you want to, as you put it very well, bear witness to what's going on, because you feel like you have a lot to add. I wouldn't say you're an expert witness, but certainly you're a witness with experience. And if you are a witness with experience, I think you can be a truer witness to what's going on.
You and your brother Rick, who you were traveling with, had satellite phones. At least I'm certain you had a satellite phone. I assume that he did too. So what was your approach to using that to call your wife or your mother and letting them know how you were? Did you want to stay in constant touch or just not share some of the more horrible things that were happening?
I think the way we use the phone is to stay in touch as much as possible. You know, you are really busy when you're in the field. I mean, you have downtime, but the truth is you're working a good 18 hours a day, and you tend to be sleeping in very strange places, like on the floor of the commander's house or in the back of your truck somewhere or whatever. It just one day turns into another, and it's very easy to lose touch. But in my case, my wife, who was a TV producer for McNeil Air, was pretty sophisticated about how I would call. And because we have the four boys, who really didn't understand why I was away that long, what Julie did is she rigged a speakerphone in their bedroom. And I would say every third night, if I had the time, and I'd work very hard to find the time, I could actually tell them a story. And that was something in this war that made me love this modern communication. It was a great way to stay in touch with the family, and also a very subtle way that I was able to let them know what I was doing. And I was basically making up these fantastic stories out of whole cloth about this kingdom and these two kings and how there was a bad king and a good king, and trying to keep them sheltered from the war, but at the same time understand that I was there for a pretty important reason, and that I wanted them to try their best to be patient and that I'd be home soon. And I think it worked. I think it kept us in touch, and it allowed us to have this family moment from a distance. It was very unique. And I think one of the things about modern communication with satellite phones in a war zone that makes it a little bit easier to be out there doing your job.
Wow. You know, once you realized that it was time to get out, and, you know, and this happened after your brother was nearly killed by a member of the Fedayeen, the Saddam Hussein militia, when you realized it was time to get out, then you had to figure out how to get out. It wasn't that easy to leave. You weren't embedded. You were on your own. Is it hard to get out of northern Iraq as an American journalist?
It is. It's very hard. For the reason that Syria is a closed-off option, because of the border is very, it's just very difficult to get across. You may, if you're lucky, if you have connections into the Syrian government, you might be able to get out that way. Very unlikely, though, and also very dangerous, because there were a lot of retreating Baathists going through these different, exits. And so you had to be very careful in that area. Turkey had proven to be a very surly and difficult ally in this war, if we can still call them an ally. And for those of us who came in through Turkey with the promise that we would return in 3 days, which I did, we were blacklisted. We were not allowed to go out because they felt we had kind of tricked them, which I guess you could argue we did, in saying you have to let us go cover this opposition conference, if everyone remembers that, way back before the war started. That got us in, and because we didn't return the day we were supposed to, we were banned from getting out that way. Going to the east, you had the possibility of Iran, but you needed to have a visa for Iran in order to get out. Or you could cross Iran through the international crossing, but that was still under kind of not control of the Iraqi remnants, but it had the Mujahideen al-Halk, this particularly vicious fighting group that is part of the Iranian opposition that was inside Iraq. Very complicated group to understand, but they're bad guys, and they were still in that zone. So the last option we had was to think about driving to Baghdad and out through Oman. And that certainly will become possible in the next week or so as those roads become secured and you can get out that way. But we found ourselves kind of throwing ourselves on the mercy of the American military that was based there. And we went in to get to know some of the people at this military fort where the special forces were staying. And there was a medical unit. It's called a FAST, or a forward surgical team, that was attached to the special forces. And they didn't have quite the intensity of the special forces, and we actually were able to gain entry to them, and we stayed with them for 2 days while we tried to wait very patiently to see if there would be room on a military cargo plane. And miraculously and spectacularly, suddenly a plane did come, and we were able to get on it. And it was a hell of a ride, but it felt so great to get out. I don't think any of us cared. We just flew out, and were thankful to be out.
What do you mean, a hell of a ride?
I have never been on a C-130 cargo plane, but they are amazing to be in because you are bouncing around, you're being jostled, you're constantly going up and down. You're on the floor, a cold steel floor, and you're constantly just bouncing off that floor. And I remember looking around at one point at all of these soldiers who had accompanied us out. It was a unit out of Alabama, a chemical weapons response team, actually, that was flying out. And all of them were sound asleep perfectly on this cold steel floor. And I realized, you know, I'm really not a soldier, man. I just could not get comfortable. And the plane is heaving and bouncing, and of course, none of it mattered because you knew within a few hours we were going to be out. And for us, out meant getting into the airfield in Romania where the U.S. military has most of its cargo planes. So we flew into Romania near the Black Sea and then drove on to Bucharest and flew out from there.
You know what I've been thinking? There are literally hundreds of journalists who've covered the war in Iraq, most of them embedded. And probably for many of them, part of what they were thinking is they'll write a book about it afterwards. But of course, if every journalist who was covering the war wrote a book, that we would just be flooded with books about the war in Iraq. Do you think about that a lot, too, about like how many journalists were there, and did you plan to write a book, and how many books are there going to be?
Well, for one thing, I've just finished writing a book about the Middle East, and as my wife put it very well, she said, your next book may be with your next wife. So I have ruled out writing a book about this war. I think there will be a lot of books written about this war, and I think there should be a lot of books written about this war. I think it's a huge turning point in the Middle East. I think it's a very important change in the way America carries itself in the world. And I very much felt part of the new empire while I was there. And I think it's a very discomforting feeling to Americans to be seen by the world as an empire. And I think they should know that that is the way much of the world is viewing us. And I think that is one of the big turning points in this story, that we were the aggressors. We went against the will of the international community. I think we did it for some very powerful and convincing reasons. But I think we did a horrible job explaining it to the world. This was essentially the right war carried out for many of the wrong reasons. And I think there's a lot to be learned from this war about the future, about the larger war on terrorism and the way in which this war might end up undercutting it. I think there's a lot to be learned about how America carries itself in the world and about an emergence of the new imperium. And we should be very aware of that. And hopefully there will be great storytellers who come out of this war who can help us become aware of all of those issues.
Did you have any fundamental changes in your opinion of the war from the time you left to go to Iraq to now when you've returned home?
I did. I mean, I went from Iraq, literally I left the day after the enormous march here in London, mm-hmm. where there were a million people in the street. A million people, you know, twice the size of Woodstock, all of whom were out there for deeply personal reasons. And I don't think that was an easy war to an easy demonstration to quantify. And there was this sense of being against the war as a very popular thing in Europe. I felt like these people didn't know Iraq, had not had the United States explain why this war was the right thing to do very well. I felt like all of those reasons for this war became crystal clear when we got to northern Iraq. Meeting the Kurds for the first time in my life, I'd been a reporter many times in Baghdad and been lied to around the clock, like every reporter there who tried to do reporting under the regime, or met the fear that people had in which they could never tell you the truth. In northern Iraq, I experienced the worst of this, you know, kind of, I was able to experience the effects of the worst of this regime. And all of this idea of taking down Saddam made great sense when you hear the voices of the Kurdish people who've been tortured, who were attacked with chemical weapons, who were imprisoned. There is not a person who doesn't have a family member who was killed by the regime. Every corner you turn, every restaurant waiter you strike up a conversation with, every person you meet waiting for something to happen, every soldier who you get to know has this very intense story. So I came from Europe, where there was this torturous discussion of the war, to the crystal clarity understanding of why it's the right thing, and then I come out of it feeling America failed in not doing a good job in the diplomacy of convincing the world why this was the right thing to do. That's where we failed, and that's where I come out of this war thinking we have a lot of work to do in explaining our position to the world and becoming much more fair in the way we carry ourselves. If we're going to be this tough on Iraq, we need to be equally tough on other allies who are also violating UN resolutions or who are also carrying themselves as dictatorships in this world. And I would say those include many countries that go beyond the, quote, axis of evil. They include Saudi Arabia, for example, or Egypt, or in some cases Israel. I think we really need to pay attention to how we're going to carry out our policy in the Middle East if we want this war ultimately to be a success.
So that we're not perceived as having a double standard.
Exactly.
Charles, I thought I'd end with an incredibly trivial question, and that is, what is the best and what is the worst food that you ate while covering the war?
The best and the worst are the same because it was one long, tedious continuum of eating the exact same thing every day.
Which was?
And this is one boiled egg for breakfast every morning. Tea, periodically in 45-minute intervals throughout the day. These are these short, sugar-packed little glasses of tea that every meeting you go into, at least three are served. And you become very wired on this tea, and you don't eat lunch because it's you're working too hard and you're just too wired from the tea and sadly the cigarettes as well. And then at night you have the exact same thing every night, which is rice and chicken kebabs. And I don't think I ever want to see another chicken kebab as long as I live. We began to loathe this stuff, and everyone would just basically joke about the fact that you've eaten chicken every night of your life for 2 months, which is which is not bad. We have the money to afford chicken. We should be very thankful. There were a lot of people in Iraq not eating anywhere near that. But the tedium of the experience left us really longing to get home. And that is certainly a truth. But of course, these little inconveniences are pretty minor in the in the grander scheme of what's going on around you.
So you're not having chicken for dinner tonight?
Definitely not.
Charles Sennett, thank you so much for sharing some of your experiences covering the war with us and your perceptions. Thank you so very much. And I'm glad you're home and safe.
Well, thanks. Glad to be home.
Charles Sennett spoke to us from London. He's a foreign correspondent for the Boston Globe, and he's the author of the book, The Body and the Blood, The Holy Land's Christians at the Turn of the Century. It's about the dwindling Christian population in the Middle East. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.